Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a band explores the Native American roots of jazz and how a new TV show paints a different picture of the Old West. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This lawless order is not only nakedly unconstitutional, it is an attack on families and children in this state and across this country.
I can't tell you how many times I've been called by the media for comment on a bill, and the reporter will ask me, well, what does Katie Hobbs think of it? And typically my answer is, I don't know.
We need a high stakes test for a couple of reasons. One is to be sure that the diploma means something, so that employers know that if you have a high school diploma, it means you've learned something. And we need it so that schools don't graduate kids that don't know anything.
At some point, our friends in the legislature are going to have to ask themselves, do you like pay raises for police and firefighters, or would you like to keep paying for grand pianos and multi-million dollar homes?
I'm frustrated that the numbers don't add up, not even close. And it makes it very difficult to have real negotiations.
When I started voting a very, very long time ago, at this point in time, I would go down to my precinct at the church or school in my neighborhood and use a paper ballot and cast my vote, and the votes were counted that night.
And joining me to talk about a member of Arizona's congressional delegation dipping his toe in the water for a gubernatorial run, Arizona's AG joining a challenge to President Trump's executive order looking to do away with birthright citizenship and more, are Marcus Sallertino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman. Aaron, good morning to you.
Great to be here.
So, Aaron, let me start with you on Attorney General Chris Mays. She joined a multi-state lawsuit. There are a few of these. Hers was, I think, Oregon, Illinois, and maybe somebody else suing to block this executive order. The judge in that case put a temporary restraining order on it, basically stopped it for a couple of weeks. This seems like something that we're going to be talking about for quite some time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I remember when then candidate Trump said, are we a nation of laws or aren't we, basically, was his kind of position. And this is what we're going to find out. He's trying to change laws voted on by Congress and signed by then the whoever was president then, with an executive order. That's not how our system works. And it's going to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and we're going to find out, you know, what if they're really calling balls and strikes there or not when this thing ultimately gets decided.
Mark, is stipulating that none of the three of us in this room are actual attorneys, it would seem as though it would be a difficult argument to make to change the Constitution with an executive order.
Yeah, I don't think I honestly think that the Trump administration knows ahead of time that one, they knew that they were going to get sued. Two, they know what's headed to the Supreme Court. But what that brings is a discussion about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And are people going to argue that, you know, if I'm Italian citizens and I come over for vacation in Florida and my wife was pregnant and we have a baby, is that an American citizen? So it's those type of things we're going to end up fleshing out in this discussion. But I will not literally not be surprised. One, the Supreme Court's going to rule this down. But two, I think it will start a discussion in Congress is do we need a constitutional amendment?
Aaron, from a political perspective, I mean, Attorney General Mays has been very upfront about, you know, she will not, I'm going to paraphrase poorly her words. But basically, she's going to try to stand up to the Trump administration, especially when it comes to things on immigration. This seems like a way, for a pretty easy one to get behind and not, you know, we've seen a number of Democrats embrace some immigration stuff
yeah.
now. This seems like a, from an outsider, a pretty easy one for a Democrat to say, this is not okay.
Yeah, well, and just to focus on, are we a nation of laws or not? She's the attorney general, definitely has a perspective on that. The reality is on immigration, the Democratic Party has completely shifted to what was the Republican Party position a decade ago. There's a near consensus on that. What will be interesting to see is if they can get anything done now that President Trump is the president, if they can get anything like the deal they had on the table just a short year ago or mm-hmm. whenever it was that actually would have done something to do what everyone kind of acknowledges. We want stronger borders. We want safer borders. And we want a legal immigration system that allows us to have people to come here to work to do the jobs that we need to get done. Let's see if we can make something happen there and actually move forward.
Marcus, not to suggest that Attorney General Mace is doing this for any reason other than this is what she thinks is right. Is this the kind of thing that helps her potentially in a campaign in 2 years?
Man, you're getting to the question I wanted to answer, so this is great. You know, when you look at the states that sued immediately, you know, what do they all have in common? They're all Democrat-controlled states, right? And so which one of these is not like the other? It's us. It's Chris Mace, who is a Democrat in a Republican-majority state.
Former Republican. She's a recovering Republican, we call that.
she's a Democrat.
Now.
So how does that pan out in 2 years for her based on the information? If you look at the last election, you know, it looks like immigration was top of mind with the voters, and certainly that's reflected in the proposition that passed. And so I think that they've got to start, you know, play a little long ball here. Yes, your Democratic base is content with that lawsuit. But where do the independents, where are they focused on? I mean, it's going to get used in a campaign ad. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And so how do they respond to it? And they got to start thinking ahead on those things.
Probably gets used in more than one campaign ad, right?
Oh, I would. This election season, despite the fact that we don't have a presidential election, will be just as much money pouring in here from special interests.
Don't turn on your TVs. Aaron, let me ask you about Governor Hobbs' budget, which he released last Friday afternoon. Republicans in the legislature had a look at it earlier this week. Seems they don't like it that much.
I'm shocked that the Republicans in the legislature aren't happy with Governor Hobbs. Look, I was thrilled to see that the governor really laid down a marker, particularly on the ESA program, which is a runaway train paying for wealthy people to send their kids to private school overwhelmingly. It just doesn't make any sense. We have some great private schools in Arizona, some great public schools. I went to both of, you know, those. If you want to send your kid to private school, pay for it, get some donations or, you know, other things for a scholarship. What is the state interest in paying for? Literally, I think her proposal was if you make under $200,000 a year, you'd still be eligible for the ESA, especially when we're struggling with to meet the basics as a state. And we know that from a budget perspective. So I was thrilled to see that. That's going to be a tough one. You know, the governor is very powerful. And in a state like Arizona, where it's narrowly divided, I personally would love to see this thing go as long as it needs and take the argument to the people and saying, really, you know, is this what we're going to choose? We'll see how it all plays out.
Says the guy no longer in the legislature. Let's take it as far as we can.
June 30th? Right? Are you crazy?
July, August, they have a much better reimbursement program down there now.
Well, so Marcus, I mean, we've seen Governor Hobbs, to Aaron's point, has talked about scaling back in some way the ESA program every year. Clearly, the Republicans are not going to go for that. But given what she's proposing on it this year, can she use that as leverage for anything else any better than she's been able to use that issue in past years?
Well, the good news is I do predict at some point we will get a budget. So that's the good news. Here's the crux of what she set up. If you save money on the ESA program, we can spend that money on immigration enforcement. And the Republicans are probably not going to fall for it. At some point, there are some things I think that they can agree on. I think, some money into the housing trust fund. I saw some block grants that go to the AG's office for local jurisdictions to enforce these smoke shops that are selling illegal marijuana to kids. I think that's it. For parents out there struggling with this stuff, we enjoy that kind of money being spent on law enforcement. There are things that I think they're going to find agreement on. I just don't think at the end of the day, this Republican majority in the Senate and the House is going to go for anything changing in ESAs.
Well, so do you think there can be enough agreement, either of you, so that we don't have the kind of budget we had a couple of years ago, what's been called the Oprah budget, where everybody gets a certain amount of money, some number of millions of dollars to spend?
All the Republicans and a small number of Democrats got the
car. Well, if you voted for it, you got the money. I
mean, yeah.
Marcus, do you think there will be enough agreement so they don't have to do that? Because we saw what happened after they did that. They had to make cuts the next year.
Yeah, I mean, that was obviously an unusual circumstance. But I right now, it looks like the Senate's following that model, but the House is not following that model. And I think that's fine for right now. Let's just start the basic discussion. But I think a lot of this money is going to be treated as one-time money, and that means capital projects. And that means more roads. We're basically going to end up
highways,
doing the same
like
thing.
That.
which is everybody earmarks a little bit of money for a road that needs repair in your district.
Aaron, what do you think? I mean, can they do a quote-unquote regular budget?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, to Marcus's point. I think the Mr. Livingston, the chairman of appropriations in the House, has said the leadership team in the House is united against not doing the earmarks, and they actually want to do a good thing for the state. That it's like the old Mike Tyson law. You know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And until you're going into Memorial Day and there's still no budget, you have to start spreading stuff around. It'll be interesting to see where this lands.
All right. Let me ask you guys quickly before we go to break about Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn. He gave his annual State of Education speech, called for the return of a high school graduation test, a high-stakes test where you cannot graduate unless you pass this. I mean, all three of us have kids who would, in theory, need to pass this at some point. Lawmakers did away with this a number of years ago. Can you see it coming back?
Well, let me tell you, my frustration on this is I'm sort of laughing in the mic, is we have pulled this rabbit out of the hat I don't know how many times. We literally do standardized tests, then we don't want the standardized test, then we want it, then we don't want it, and it's like a carousel just going round and round. And at some point, I'd just like a decision made and just be over it. I am doubtful that it could make it through the legislature. There's no doubt about that. I'm very doubtful the governor would sign it.
Okay. Aaron, what do you think?
This might be the first time since I've been doing this show that I'm going to agree with something that that Tom Horn is saying. I think tests like this really put a focus on all kids learning, and that's a good idea. I'm happy my own son isn't listening right now because he's in school, because he would be groaning. But the reality is, I was in favor of high-stakes tests. It puts the impetus on teachers to teach and on students to learn and everybody to get focused on what's really going on. I don't know what good we're doing for a young person to say you're a high school graduate if you actually haven't really learned anything.
Well, so how do we avoid, though? Sorry to interrupt. How do we avoid what happened last time, to Marcus's point, where we had a test, people weren't passing it, we had a new test, students still weren't passing it, we kept sort of making it easier to pass until they eventually passed it?
Yeah. I mean, I have a whole list of things that I would do. I'd start with preschool for every kid in Arizona, which would dramatically eventually change the outcomes. I'd have way more certified and specialized teachers in the classrooms because we'd be paying them decently. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately we'd get to smaller class size so every kid could learn. And, you know, the reality is it's not a mystery. And like super conservative states like Florida have class size limits that are, you know, 30-40% lower than what we have in Arizona. But that's what those things do. It's the old Lucy, you know, moving the football.
Yeah.
Like the test is the test. Let's figure out what it takes to actually help kids learn and make those investments as a state. That's why, by the way, that the ESA thing is so pernicious, because instead of actually fixing class size for the vast majority, overwhelming number of our Arizona kids in our Arizona public schools, we're helping millionaires literally pay for private school. Like, that's a values choice we have made as a state legislature and a then governor, and that's what we need to retrade to get focused on helping every kid learn.
All right. That is Aaron Lieberman. I'm also joined by Marcus Dellertino. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman and Marcus Dellertino of First Strategic. Marcus, let me start with you on Andy Biggs, Arizona congressman, former state lawmaker, has filed a committee to sort of explore the possibility of running for governor. Is this a surprise to you at all, especially given that President Trump basically said, Karen Taylor Robeson, if you decide to run, you've got my support?
Yeah, that was a little bit of a jaw dropper. Now, do I know that Andy wants to come home? Yeah. Do I know he's not having like the funnest time he's ever had in Congress? Yeah. But I didn't expect him to go run for governor. I do sense that there's something strange happening here. I don't have my finger on it, but this feels weird. I mean, Travis Grantham then jumps into the CD race for that congressional district.
Yeah, within former state lawmaker.
Minutes. And so that was clearly coordinated,
yeah.
I felt.
Clearly.
And so there's something also going on. There's something bad's going down at 7-Eleven, as we used to say as kids.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
And also, I mean, what Republicans said the minute it happened was, oh, no, not again. And so I think every Republican was holding their breath for a clean primary. let's just have one candidate and let's get through the primary and let's have that general ballot. And this mucks it up.
Well, so how analogous do you let's say that he does decide to run and Karen Taylor Robeson are the two candidates. How analogous is that primary to the one we saw 2 years ago between Karen Taylor Robeson and Carrie Lake?
It's a little different in a couple ways. One is Trump, as you mentioned, has basically endorsed Karen if she gets in the race. One. Two, a PAC was immediately set up, a super PAC, that is run by, the Trump team, if you will, to help Karen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will be difficult. We've certainly seen those scenarios, right,
but where Trump endorsed two candidates.
He
endorsed two candidates in the congressional primary. I mean, if you think Donald Trump's word going into an election means anything, you have not been paying attention.
That could happen. There's no doubt about it. But it doesn't equalize the super PAC funding that will be coming. And by the way, let's also not forget Karen's pretty well financed.
Yeah,
in
she doesn't really
campaign.
Need a super PAC.
Mr. Biggs has not had to aggressively fundraise pretty much his entire time in Congress. I mean, it was sort of that seat was a Republican lock.
Well,
so
let's just go back. How badly was Carrie Lake outspent in her primary, by Karen Taylor Robeson? 3-1, 4-1 or something like that? I mean, the Republican primary voter is not influenced by a splashy TV commercial or anything else like that. We've seen this again and again and again. I just say, run, Andy, run. This is great news. Not since Carrie Lake, said she was going to double down and run for Senate have I been this excited about a Republican candidate. And the reality is the base Republican voter is really a fan of these far-right candidates. I mean, that's what we've seen. And that's the reason Democrats have been winning statewide. I think that's what opens up, creates an opportunity, because then they lose narrowly in a general election. But I think this is a great development for the Governor Hobbs, for sure.
What do you say something doesn't feel right? Like what are you looking for to see, like, maybe what's going on behind the scenes here?
I've got to make some phone calls. I'm not going to tell you who I'm calling.
Sure.
But the sense of it was just sort of strange. The timing of the immediate jump in by Travis, that was, I thought was coordinated. Is there somebody specifically that's begging Biggs to get in this race? I will tell you that most Republicans that I talk to are tired of losing. And so I think,
what Aaron said is correct. They swept the legislature.
However, the fact of the matter is, like, it's dawned on them that they have to have a winning candidate. And mm-hmm. I think that is different this cycle than it was 2 years ago, that they are focused on who can win.
So you're saying the fever has broken and the Republican primary voter has become strategic and playing the long game. Go look at the comments in some of these articles, like huge, just regular people, not the folks who are following what's going on in the statehouse, regular people, tons of stuff around, oh, I'll never vote for Karen Taylor Robeson. Oh, it's so great that Biggs is in there, da-da-da. By the way, there's also some, we're so sick of losing, he's too conservative. But the average Joe voter is going to like what Andy Biggs is serving up in a Republican primary.
Marcus, do you think that Biggs cannot win? Like, do you not think there's a chance that if he was going up against Katie Hobbs, he could win?
No. I think any Republican going into this next cycle has a good chance. There's no doubt about it. Look, it's 2 years away. Anything's humanly possible.
Right.
For somebody to sit here and say so-and-so is going to win, it's absolute insanity.
Who do you think has a better chance to beat Governor Hobbs, Karen Taylor Robeson or Andy Biggs?
I'm not going down that road. I mean, and look, all of that is absent of this discussion. I know everybody loves to – I got to defend the Republicans. But let's not forget the Democratic Party is a mess in itself. I mean, they've been attacking Rubin viciously this week. Calling him Kyrsten Sinema. You've got a new party chair. You threw out the one that was endorsed by every Democrat. I mean, look, both
this
parties
is a look
are,
over
are
there.
Getting
this is a look over there argument right
water
there.
Water skiing squirrel
exactly,
over
when he doesn't like the topic that's going on.
Well, so let's talk about voting. We're talking about the next election because there's a bill that a House committee approved this week that would do away with vote centers. These are places where in the county any voter can go to any of these vote centers. You get your ballot printed out. They seem to be fairly popular, especially in a place like Maricopa County where, you can live and work, many miles away from each other. Aaron, does this seem like one of those election-type bills that even if it makes it through the legislature, Governor Hobbs will say no thanks?
I suspect she will. And as Secretary of State, I mean, we had polling places, and it could be a complete nightmare. There's just more things to go wrong. There is no perfect system. My wife surprised me this morning talking to me about how she thought we should do stuff to get to our results faster. And so I think there is an opening there. I think Gina Cobb was on the show talking a little bit about some of the things that we could do. Getting away from voting centers does not make sense to me. It actually makes things much more efficient because you're not sitting there trying to figure out, are you in this polling place or not? When my first election, we were in polling places. Regularly, people would show up and be told, yeah, this is not your polling place. You drove by here, but you got to go over there. Mm. Some of those people never make it. That's why we moved to that voting center model. I think we can have some reforms to get to a quicker election day result, but this is not a good idea.
And Marcus, do you think that there might be an opening here for some kind of compromise, be it something else?
I mean, I talked about this back in December, that my bold prediction was that the governor was going to sign something on elections this cycle. And to that point, by the way, Democrats in the legislature need to give her a little wiggle room to be able to do that. That, you know, as Aaron just said, even Democrats are a little frustrated by the amount of time. So they need to be cautious in allowing her to be able to sign that bill. One. Two, what's absent a little bit from this discussion is that these vote centers are filling a hole because it is very, very difficult for counties to find facilities for polling places, right? And so churches are able to say, no, thank you. We don't want to deal with that potential drama or liability on our property. And it's happening everywhere. And so, you know, now that we're looking at schools, well, guess what? Parents aren't really excited about having that potential hot flash point on their kids' campus.
Or giving kids a day off where they have to find childcare if they work.
Oh, there's nothing worse for a parent having to hear that. Like, like 3-day weekend. Oh, no, thank you. God, I hope my wife's not listening. But anyway, so these are some of the things that we're going to have to work through. I mean, are high schools maybe acceptable? I don't know. But it can't
There's not that many high schools. We're talking about one for every 1,000 voters. The church that was our polling place in Paradise Valley is leveled and is being, you know, made into, you know, luxury homes right now. Like, there's just not that many places around where you could do this. Again, I think there is. I think Marcus makes a really good point. There can be something done here. This feels like the wrong solution to me.
All right. So, Aaron, when you were in the legislature, did you ever have the desire to have the governor come down and to be able to ask her or him questions?
I am intrigued by this because I can count on one hand the number of times we saw Governor Ducey. It was the state of the state speech. That was it. One time at a bill signing. It was a very interesting kind of prime minister's questions.
Yeah.
You know, whatever.
After the British government does this.
My immediate thought was, could they send DPS to go compel the, like, what if the governor just says, no, I'm not doing it. Like, I'm the governor. Are we going to have one of these situations that, you know, we were always talking about where they send DPS to go get the missing lawmaker or whatever else? Is the governor going to get escorted down there? The one thing I was completely confident of is that if the legislature was the same party as the governor, we would not be having this proposal. There is no doubt. It was funny to me. It was a party line vote. I guarantee you, if things were reversed, it would have flipped around. I actually think it's an interesting idea and you know, to be able to engage directly with folks and hear those conversations. I can't quite figure out what you do if the governor just says, I'm not doing it at that point.
That's interesting.
You need a willing, you know, willing participant on both sides.
Well, and Marcus, to Aaron's point, this also came up during the Napolitano administration, right? A lawmaker then said, hey, we should have the governor come down and field questions. I mean, everything else aside, it would be super interesting TV, right?
Oh, it'd be good for the press. But look, there's no way it's happening. There's no governor that's like, I can't wait to spend my time talking to the legislature.
But by the way,
they are an executive power. They are going to say there is a separation of powers. They're going to do everything humanly possible. And also, the conversations go a lot better if you just call them up one at a time up to your office and say, okay, how are we going to work this out? Rather than standing in front of a microphone and 90 legislators peppering you with questions.
There would definitely be a lot of grandstanding. I will tell you, I ran into
there would be grandstanding during this kind of thing, Aaron? Come on.
For everybody watching at home, that's what people used to say in the and I'd say, nobody's watching at home. There's a few lobbyists in their office. You know, there's no one else watching. People might be watching this. But I'll tell you, I ran into Governor Symington once a few years ago, and he told me, which kind of shocked me, that he used to show up at the Democratic caucus, not to just to like, you know, for fun in terms of making it more of a cordial relationship. We never saw anything like that when I was in the legislature. And people don't realize everything is actually quite close together. I mean, you can get to the governor's office in a 90-second walk. But you seldom take that walk, especially if you're the opposing party and, you know, a new lawmaker. So I just think it's an interesting idea. It is amazing to me how little attention gets paid to the Arizona legislature when how much it affects the lives of Arizonans. And I think things that actually brought that more front and center is probably a good idea, but this one seems to face long odds.
All right, last word goes to you, Marcus. If this passes, and as you say, the governor's probably not going to sign this, if this were to go into effect, is there any reason to think that, like, people might learn something and get some reasonable information out of this kind of question and answer session?
No, it'll be completely politically charged. What kind of quote can I get out of you that I can use on a mail piece or a TV commercial? That's what it will be about in today's day and age. Maybe if it was in the 70s and the 80s, it might be a different discussion. But right now, it's just sort of campaign fodder.
Maybe they should do it without any TVs. Maybe that's the answer.
Just radio.
Just a members-only thing to really hash it out.
That's interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Aaron Lieberman, Marcus Delatino, thanks you both for coming in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, clowns, acrobatics, and juggling, a look into the magic of the Zope Family Circus. But first, when Julia Keefe isn't performing her own original jazz compositions, she directs the Indigenous Big Band, a group dedicated to spotlighting the rich history of Native American artists in jazz. The band performs this weekend at ASU Gamage. Keefe recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about her long journey toward blending her identities as a jazz artist and a Native American artist.
My earliest musical memory is of listening to Billie Holiday and falling in love with that jazz orchestra sound and the muted trumpets in particular. A trumpet with a harmon mute became something that was so hauntingly beautiful to me.
Not now.
But it really wasn't until going into high school, it wasn't until I really started that formal jazz education that I stumbled across the name Mildred Bailey.
Wham! Rebop! Boom! Bam! I can sing and I can jam.
Who was the first woman to sing in front of a big band in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And she was of Coeur d'Alene descent. And that was the first time that I made that connection that historically speaking, I could see myself represented in this music.
If I can do it, you can too.
What did you feel when you listened to her music for the first time?
The first time I listened to Mildred Bailey, it was incredibly exciting being able to listen to a native jazz vocalist sing in front of a big band.
Yeah.
And have that be part of the historical and linguistic framework of jazz, that she was an instrumental part of the evolution of jazz and her participation in it. You know, there's that lineage from her to me.
Absolutely. Well, in thinking about your project and getting ready to talk to you, I've been reminded of this quote that I heard from Wendell Pierce once. He was the star of the show Tremé, and he's also he's a big scholar of jazz. And he said once, he loves jazz because to him, jazz is America. It's freedom within form. But one of the things that that implies is this idea of boundaries and strictures. And in my own experience with jazz and interest in jazz, as much as it has a reputation for being this kind of freewheeling, you know, there's no rules sort of music, it, there can be, and please tell me if you disagree, sort of a purity culture associated with it. And it occurred to me that as much as jazz has been so critical in establishing the vitality of Black artists in this country, the vitality of female artists in this country, I would have to imagine that as you have made your way forward in this work, you have bumped up against resistance or strictures or boundaries in your attempt to do the same uplifting work of artists like Mildred Bailey.
Oh, absolutely. For a long time, I really didn't acknowledge my own Indigenous identity while I was on the bandstand because of that resistance or conflict within the listener or audience member. I felt that I really only had permission to acknowledge my indigeneity on the bandstand when I was talking about Mildred Bailey. It's like, see, look, here's the historical precedent. I'm allowed to be here.
Hmm. Well, and this gets to this phenomenon in jazz of, I think one could say, arguably appropriating Native American culture.
Brave Indian warrior, since first I met you, I can't forget you, Cherokee sweetheart, child of the prairie.
I do think that a lot of 20th century composers were intrigued by this notion of, you know, American Indian peoples, Native peoples. And I do think a lot of that stems from the way that Hollywood saw Native peoples during that time period.
Yeah, so we're talking about like the 40s through the 60s here.
Yes, the height of the Western. And it even, you know, you saw it in from black and white films all the way through, you know, the height of, you know, spaghetti Westerns. That interpretation of what it is to be a Native, and more times than not, you know, it is that pure savagery or that romanticism and fetishism of indigenous cultures.
Me got back and put in my house. If I want, they're gonna make me shout. I'm going down and I get my squaw. Me might buy a great big car. I'm gonna do everything I could. Me big chief, I'm feeling good. Me big chief, I got him tried.
At the time period, the over-caricaturizing indigeneity was really popular in Hollywood, but then also, you know, in the music world too. So, you know, it's a very complicated and nuanced conversation and history.
Yes, but it seems to me that with your work with the Julie Keefe Indigenous Big Band, you're really kind of drawing a circle around the need for focus on this, just really kind of shining a spotlight on it. And I watched a video of the Indigenous Big Band performing at Joe's Pub last year. And before you played a composition called Blood Quantum, you spoke to the audience.
So this final tune, it's called Blood Quantum. And Blood Quantum is a colonial construct that is meant to disenfranchise, disenroll, and erase Indigenous peoples. I know it's not fun to talk about.
And you said, quote, that the Indigenous Big Band stands in indignant defiance of policies like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in an original song that you wrote called Broken Things, you sing about the idea that everybody has their damage, everybody has their broken things. And the song, at least as I interpreted it, was a wish for an integrative way for broken people to come together. And, you know, perhaps we could extend that to a broken country.
'Cause you've got your demons, love, and I've got mine.
Tell me about the relationship between that defiance and that more, I don't know, I'm tempted to say empathetic or integrative spirit that you're expressing in that song.
I think it's, again, one of those instances of both can exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So part of what I do outside of being a musician is I work with American Indian and Alaska Native peoples in the public health sector. Mm-hmm. And so I've done a lot of work in substance abuse and suicide prevention. I've done a lot of work in the boarding school healing initiatives, working on a toolkit for public health administrators on how to talk about the boarding school experience and the lasting impacts of that genocidal practice, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Part of that defiance, that indignant defiance of federal and governmental and institutional practices is creating human connection and building up people's capacity for empathy. I think being vulnerable is a superpower, and showing each other our humanity and, you know, the our brokenness mm-hmm. builds that connection that actually disables the mechanisms of institutional racism and governmental practices that are meant to break us apart.
Well, Julia Keefe is a jazz vocalist, a conductor, an actor, an activist, an educator, and the director of the Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band, which will be at ASU Gamage on January 25th. Julia, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Sam, for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Westerns are everywhere right now, from the massive hit that is Yellowstone and its rather romanticized vision of Western lore, to a new limited series that takes a decisively different approach, American Primeval.
There's war brewing in this territory. Brigham Young trying to make his kingdom. Prison trying to stomp it out. These natives here don't murder you. You got the Wasatch Mountain Range. Grizzly wolves, riled up Mormons.
We are the chosen!
Set in 1857 during the Utah War, the show strips the romance from the Wild West. The characters are covered in grime. The film is stripped of color. The story is as grim as history actually was, or at least that's the approach the filmmakers have said they tried to take. Our next guest says they did it with some successes and some failures, and that our cultural obsession with the call of the West right now has a lot to do with our current politics. Rebecca Onion is a senior editor at Slate, and she's written about Yellowstone and American Primeval. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
I think that stripping the romance from things in the American West is like another way of creating lore, in my opinion, which I think it succeeds at pretty well. And, you know, reading the way that the people who made the show expressed themselves about the show, they were very excited about that idea that this would be something honest that hadn't been represented before. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that's possible. Now, I will say that I felt very grim watching this show the entire time. I don't know about you, but I definitely did. You know, whereas, for example, if you watch the Yellowstone prequels, which are probably the most direct comparison in terms of the timing that they're set in, 1883, for example, there are love stories that like carry you along a little bit. There's like a strong family relationship. But in American Primeval, there is this sort of like little family that Peter Bergen, Mark L. Smith, who made the show, are trying to sort of set up. And there are ways that your heart can kind of like, at least for me, there were moments where I was like, oh, okay, like maybe these people are actually, you know, they're helping each other. They're collaborating.
Yeah.
They're getting past obstacles. They're trying to succeed at something. But as soon as that gets built up for you, it kind of gets ripped away in a way that I will not spoil.
Yes, don't spoil. So it's like the storyline is grim, right? There's a lack of characters that you're rooting for, right? Which happens in a lot of shows today. But there's also like this really stripped of color and dirty and like kind of just muddy and gross reality that they're trying to show here. Describe that for us, like for people who haven't seen this. It's very, they're trying to be very realistic in a very grim way.
You know, I read a New York Times piece about the making of American Primeval. One of the sound designers was quoted saying that Peter Berg had him strip out all of the bird song from the sound, which I was so struck by. The look of the show has that like blue gray kind of like stripped out tone to it, which I know they do on purpose to try to make it look less beautiful. I mean, the American West is beautiful. And, you know, if you see, I watched The Revenant right before I wrote about American Primeval, because Mark L. Smith, who wrote American Primeval, wrote The Revenant. And so it's from 2015, obviously. And I had not seen it before. And I was so blown away by how beautiful it looked. I mean, that is a grim story too. Leonardo DiCaprio's character gets mauled by a bear and betrayed by everybody who's supposed to be collaborating with him, almost everybody. But the way that the visuals are, you know, you see the like the green of the trees against the white of the snow.
Right.
And that's not the way it is in American Primeval. You don't get the joy of the landscape.
Right. Which does something to the audience as you're watching it, right? Like you have a visceral reaction to that, I think. But it's not, as you're saying, like the first Western in recent years that has really tried to show the West as it quote unquote truly was, right?
No.
I'm thinking of like Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, which kind of did this as well for me. What do you think is happening in American culture? Not just that we're obsessed with Westerns right now, which we are, but there seems to be this real pull to sort of see the West in this reality that is not flowery, not romantic in any way.
This is a very cynical take I'm about to put forth. In a way, I wonder if it's partly that Hollywood has returned to intellectual property quite a bit over the past, 20 years. It's the reason why there are so many Marvel movies. It's the reason why there are so many reboots and remakes instead of new properties. And when it comes to historical fiction, those of us who like to consume historical fiction, of which I count myself among the number, will see that there are certain phases and times that writers and movie makers return to quite a bit. And the American West is a great one. People sort of know the outline of the idea. So you can frame a story within, you know, the players, the characters that you're going to see there, the conflicts, the strife, like people kind of have a sense of what happened. And then you can subvert it in different ways by, you know, making it funny, like the HBO show Deadwood, which I absolutely loved. Or you could do a twist like the contemporary Yellowstone, the Taylor Sheridan show, which is set in contemporary times, but it's still working with the iconography of the cowboy. And I also think that in a way it works for us because the West is, there's a lot of stories of dispossession and like feeling like you had something and you're losing it, or like you came here to have it and now you're about to lose it. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people are thinking about a lot in the United States right now.
That brings me to my final question, which I think is what you're starting to get at there, which is that all pop culture kind of reflects the moment that it's being made in, not just the moment that it's being made about, right? Why do you think we want to watch these shows right now, whether it's a romantic version like Yellowstone or whether it's this really not romantic version in a show like American Primeval? Like, is this about tapping into something that we are hungry for right now in our culture?
In politics, there's a huge fight over how American history is going to be remembered and re-represented to kids in school, to, you know, college students in colleges, in monuments, in, you know, in fictions also.
Yeah.
So I find watching Yellowstone absolutely fascinating in that respect, because I know that it is enjoyed by people sort of across a political spectrum in a way that a lot of other television shows I don't think are. And the way that that show gives everybody a little bit of something, you know, it gives people who are sort of anti-liberal and like annoyed at what they perceive as sort of like overly cosmopolitan urban people, it gives them a feeling of satisfaction. But it also, because it's about, you know, cowboys and how great they are. But, you know, you don't have to be conservative or sort of like leaning on that side of things to enjoy these storylines that are about how families have conflict over generations and over time they sort of like evolve a different way of living with each other, or storylines that are just about action, like there's action in them, which is fun to watch.
Yeah.
And even for people who are consider themselves peace loving, I think that there's a way that everyone across the political spectrum in the US can kind of find something in those stories that's for them.
Which is rare right now, right?
Yes, increasingly.
Yeah.
Increasingly, in a way that you can't necessarily do as much with, you know, a story about Vietnam, a story about the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. It's hard to sort of make fictions that contain within themselves all sides of the story. But people who make stories about the American West really love to try to do that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they succeed.
Sometimes they succeed. All right, we will leave it there for now. Rebecca Onion, senior editor with Slate, joining us to talk about this. Rebecca, thank you so much for your perspective here. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
And finally today, there is a show in Tucson which offers a very literal interpretation of family entertainment. Sam Dingman has the story.
Giovanni Zoppe is a clown. He's always been a clown, ever since he was a little kid. One of his earliest memories is from when he was 2 years old. He and his family were at the circus.
And I ran out into the ring and took a bow. And I tore the house down. The only problem was I was completely naked.
Giovanni's family was at the circus that day because Giovanni's family is the circus. The Zoppe Family Circus. They've been touring the world for 180 years. And like his father and his grandfather before him, Giovanni Zoppe is the ringleader. A Zoppe show features all kinds of circus acts. Bareback horse riding, tightrope walking, trapeze. But Giovanni is the glue that holds it all together. He plays Nino the Clown, a character that serves as a kind of proxy for the audience. Throughout the show, Nino the Clown is constantly trying to jump into the ring and get in on the action. The other performers won't let him in, but Nino is no quitter. He keeps trying over and over until, finally, they give in.
The clown almost always ends on top. I'll bumble around in the beginning, but at the end, I'm doing the actual thing.
At a recent performance, a young boy wandered on stage with Nino the Clown, and for a moment, the little boy became part of the show. Afterwards, Nino carried him into the crowd to find his parents, and the boy's father had tears in his eyes, but he was smiling. Giovanni says that's the magic of the circus. It's a place where the impossible seems possible. As we spoke, Giovanni was standing on the street in Tucson, getting ready for rehearsal.
I'm at the Mercado right now, and I see a gentleman here with a bald head. If I went up to him right now and rubbed his head and kissed it, I would probably get my butt kicked. But when I do that, when I'm a Zanino, it's fine.
Right.
It's funny. It's great.
The Zoppe Family Circus performs in Tucson this weekend.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.